Well, this past year was the first year in 23 years that Tucson was kind of an official, unofficial feast site. Those of you that were here will understand what that means. But we had live speaking, and I want to thank Jesse and Diane, as I have before, for maintaining a local site through the years, through 23 years. It's been amazing. The last time we held a feast with live speaking was in 1996 in Tucson. Prior to that time, the history of the feast in Tucson had gone all the way back to 1973, as most of you remember. And some of you were here every year for that time. From 1973, were any of you here from that entire time? Did you begin? Maybe, okay, Gina, all right. But maybe not many, because the church grew and grew after that particular period of time, and some of you may have been transferring to other sites. But at any rate, since 1973, there's been a continuous feast of some kind operated in Tucson, and that was 46 years in a row. So it was actually my 47th feast this past year, and I began keeping the feast in 1972. But we moved to Tucson in 1988, and from that time on until 1996, we had anywhere from, at the latter stages with United, 95 and 96, maybe 2,500 to 3,000 people for the first couple of feasts for United in this region. And prior to that time, we'd had more. But my purpose today is twofold. I want to give you a short history of what has happened during the feast in Tucson through the years, and then springboard into a history of God's people keeping the holy days, especially the Feast of Tabernacles. About 12 years ago, many of you remember about that time, you know that I was working outside of the ministry. I had engaged full-time in 1999 in the pharmaceutical industry. And about 12 years ago, I'd moved from one company to the other. And, you know, that's the nature of that game. But I was in the middle of kind of this brand new career that I had outside of the ministry in pharmaceutical sales. And over the past, and I've retired at the end of 2017, as you know, but I made a lot of friends over the last 20 years in the medical community, and meeting a lot of doctors and a lot of staff people, and probably for most of you that visit your regular doctor, chances are I know them, whether they're here or Green Valley or Oro Valley, or maybe even some cases my territory is extended to El Paso, to New Mexico, or the whole state of New Mexico, as a matter of fact, for about 6-5 years, and then to the southern, well, the lower East Valley of the Phoenix area, the Valley of the Sun, all the way to Yuma and parts in between. So I've covered all of that and down to Sierra Vista as well. For those of you, hi Sierra Vista, I forgot to mention anything to the Sierra Vista members, but I know most of the doctors there that you would go to see on a regular business. So a lot of friends, still have a lot of good relationships in all of those areas, but about 12 years ago, one of my colleagues who was in another division, and when you're working for a company like ours, just FYI, if you have separate divisions, it's like they work for a different company because you never cross paths with them. You never have meetings with them. So somebody in the neuroscience division of our company, like I would knew that he was a Lilly rep and I knew that he was a coworker, but we would never see each other because he had a division with about 5 or 6 probably 12 or 14 people in his district, and I had a different division, and so we would never cross paths, but we would always share information about customers if we felt it was necessary. And one day Brent came to me with the name of a physician that I normally wouldn't call on. He wouldn't be on my call list because he was in a specialty that you wouldn't normally associate with the disease state that I represented. And so he had been talking to one of his pain management specialist physicians, whom I had never met. And this physician was talking to him about some issues of pain that had developed with a lot of his, especially female patients, sometimes male patients, that he had no way to address. And since I was 2 or 3 years into the launch of a drug that addressed those concerns, then he said, well, you should talk to my friend Steve. And he said, send him in. And so I went in to visit with this doctor. And I don't know if Steve is watching today, Capitol Steve, who, as he proudly proclaimed, helped train me to some extent when he recruited me for that particular position. But back in the day when he started in pharmaceutical sales, you always sat in the doctor's office and waited to talk. As years went by, they were just so pressured for time, you couldn't really do that. It was stand up in the hallway, talk to him, and then, you know, sign for samples and get out of there. But this doctor, this particular doctor, was kind of old school. He didn't really have to work, so he didn't see a lot of patients. So he always would make you wait in his office, and then he would come in and he would talk to you for an extended period of time. And so it was a very delightful experience in getting to meet this particular doctor. And we had a nice chat, and we talked about the product that I was representing, and he asked about it. And it's really nice when you can deal with people and you can help them to learn something that, you know, maybe they didn't learn in medical school. And since he was in this particular specialty of pain management medicine, he didn't learn this, but he was willing to talk. And even from a lowly rep, you know, a drug salesman, he was willing to learn. And I found it just a very stimulating opportunity to get to know him and his staff. And they were really one of my favorite offices to talk to. But through the course of the next few months, and this goes back to like 2005 or so, during the course of the next few months, I found out something that really was stunning to me. The doctor's name is Sheldon Gingrich, and I'll just put a name to you. You probably never went to him as a physician, I would guess, but Dr. Gingrich graduated from the University of Arizona back in the late 60s or maybe the early 70s, and he didn't go to medical school immediately. It wasn't until later on in his career, or later on after a few years, that he would decide to go back to medical school. But in 1972, he found himself working for the brand newly completed Tucson Community Center. And he was working as kind of a, you know, somebody, a recent college graduate. He's doing a lot of different things. And one of the tasks that he was assigned was working with customers of the community center, people who would rent out the space. So the Tucson Community Center was finished and completed in 1972. Tucson Community Center was one of the first of large public buildings that the Worldwide Church of God would use to conduct the Feast of Tabernacles. As many of you will remember the history of how the Worldwide Church of God grew to be so big and big and big that the first step, the first phase in being able to conduct feast sites where you had, you know, the attendance was growing in the 50s from 5,000 nationally to 10,000, then it would double again and double again. And so the church's response to that, as you remember, most of you will remember, of course, is that we started building buildings. We started accumulating land, and we bought places like, you know, places in the Poconos, places in the Wisconsin Dells, places in the Ozarks of Missouri. And we built these big, huge steel buildings, and we would use them once a year. And in many cases, they were very adequate. Now, I say Northern California was one of the areas, the first areas in which, in the mountains of Northern California and Squaw Valley, that particular arena was built originally to hold the portion of the Winter Olympics, as you may remember. I think it was 1960. I think that's when it was. But it was still around, and the church used it for a number of years. I think it may have begun in 1968, and it used it for a number of years. That was one of the first public buildings in which we would use for the Feast of Tabernacles. Okay, maybe I need to put this up. I'm noticing a little It's coming in and out a little bit, isn't it? Maybe I need to put this up a bit. Okay, so, but I know, but back in those days, Squaw Valley was one of the first of public buildings. And by that time, they had built Big Sandy out. They had built a convention center in Big Sandy. They had built the Poconos out, the Wisconsin Dells, Lake of the Ozarks. And they had reached capacity in all of those sites. In some cases, well, I remember in 1974, I went to the feast in the Poconos. There's like 14,000 people there. And people will always try to connect with other members. You remember those days? You go into this large, large site. And we didn't have cell phones back in those days. We didn't have any means of communicating with one another once we got to the feast unless you had exchanged, you know, where you were going to be. So back in those days, the method of communication, you try to hook up or find somebody that, you know, from Missouri or from California, you go to a big bulletin board and you put a card, so-and-so, please find me, you know, see me at this address, and you'd give your chalet number. Do you guys remember this? I mean, this was the most incredible thing. And it happened everywhere because people always like to connect. Well, Tucson was one of those places that was what they were building out. Communities, cities were building out these community centers at that particular time. And Tucson was one of the first, and I think maybe the first of a public building that was designed for conventions and community events to be used for that particular purpose. And guess what? Newly graduated from the University of Arizona, Sheldon Gingrich, not a doctor, 22, 23 years old at the time, was sent. Tucson was probably about a quarter of the size it is today. Tucson was probably a town of 100,000 or less in the early 70s. But Sheldon Gingrich was sent to the Tucson airport to pick up four or five very nicely dressed in suits. Of course, it was the summertime. Everybody was wearing suits in the 70s, no matter where you lived. But he picked up four or five officials. I don't know who he picked up. He didn't pick up you, did he, Mr. LaRavia? But there were four or five people that were from the festival office. And Sheldon Gingrich told me that once he found out that I had any affiliation with the Church of God, and that happened through our discussions over a number of months, he told me this story. He was the first contact in the city of Tucson for the worldwide Church of God. And it wasn't the local minister who was living here at the time that was sent to pick these guys up at the airport. It was Sheldon Gingrich. And he was a young guy. He's kind of a funny guy. You might even say kind of a smart aleck. He tried to crack some jokes about churches and stuff like that. And that kind of went over like a lead balloon, you know, kind of fell flat in his face, and everybody somber-faced riding in from the airport, which was, you know, the roads are not great from the airport to downtown. They're probably less so back then, and probably two-lane, whatever. But he was the first contact for Worldwide Church of God, and I told him later, we came anyway. Despite your efforts, we came anyway. So later on, Dr. Gingrich then went back to medical school at the University of Arizona and became a doctor. And then many years later, I would meet him. And maybe there is a lesson there somewhere along the line. You should never assume that you won't run into somebody that somewhere along the line has had some contact with either you, your family, your friends, or whatever. But that particular visit prompted him to learn about Herbert Armstrong, prompted him to learn. Now, he didn't learn for the purpose of, like, being interested in a church or anything, but he knew a lot about us. Now, he did know a lot of misinformation, which over the course of time I was able to say, you know, Dr. Gingrich, not everything you hear is true. And he accepted it because he trusted me. And because he trusted Brent, the other rep from Lilly. And I was able to talk to him not too long ago. He retired last year, but just a great guy. over the years, I've met a number of people who were here during the 23 years leading up until the time in which the feast site here was closed officially, and then moved to San Diego. And, you know, we helped out at San Diego and then in Escondido, and it went great, you know, because people cooperate. People get along. The people of the church do that, and they know why they're there at the Feast of Tabernacles anyway. They realize why they are attending the Feast of Tabernacles, and, you know, things that would be problems elsewhere or for other conventions suddenly are not problems for us. Not that they're not problems, but because people are moved by a different spirit and a different attitude and want to do things differently, it works. And we overcome obstacles. That's what we are. We are called the Israel of God because, like our spiritual forefather, Jacob, we are all overcomers. You come into this church, you come into the church of God, and you become of Israel. You become of the Israel of God. You are an overcomer. That is the name that God has given to you. But I've met a bunch of people. When we first started working here with the Feast in 1988 and up until the time it left and departed for the San Diego area, I met a lot of people through the years that would visit here every year. They would come and they would transfer into Tucson, and had a lot of stories of, now we had, in terms of attendance, probably we got close to 6,500 was maybe the tops, because we, during those years, the late 80s and the 90s, as you remember, we kind of expanded some of the feast sites to other communities where they would have, you know, some of the buildings like Tucson would have. So the attendance kind of came down a little bit, but still, Tucson was a very popular place for many, many years. And people love coming here, and they love the uniqueness of the Sonoran Desert and, you know, just everything that the area has to offer. So it was very vibrant. People remember kind of some erroneous things because they'd see that convention center filled, and the actual attendance, if you have everything for a basketball game, they could probably cram in 10,000 people into that particular arena, which they use for ice hockey now. But they never had close to that for the feast. And people remember 9,000 people coming here for the feast. No, I've got the official statistics that go back every year. And the highest that Tucson reached was about 7,500. But that is a lot of people for 8 days in a community. And you'd better believe that the people of Tucson always loved that. Not the money spent. They loved our people, just as they have in every feast site that I have ever been in, where we have made an impact. Rapid City, boy, they loved the, we got up to like close to 3,500, maybe even close to 4,000 people, and using their arena when by the time that we had left, and people coming to Rapid City. There's so much to do there as well. It was great. But the tourist trade in Rapid City is like a 3-month period. So from April maybe, or basically when school is out, that's when the proprietors, the restaurateurs and the hotels and all of them, they basically make their season during that time. But when the feast started there in 1980, when the feast started there, wow, we've had like, I think, close to 2,000, maybe 1,900 the first year, and that kind of grew and grew, and the word spread, and people wanted to come there. They wanted to go see Mount Rushmore. They wanted to go see Crazy Horse Memorial. They wanted to go see all the places in the Black Hills and see the beauty that was inherent in that particular part of the country, and they came. And it grew and grew to about, I think 4,000 is about all we could take there. And but the one thing, and I worked really closely with the merchants in Rapid City, and they didn't talk about, you know, how much they loved the business and the income and everything. What they talked about was the spirit of the people and how that affected them and how they were so happy that, you know, because you don't know if you got a church group coming, you don't know, maybe these people are going to be weird and strange, which we were, but also on top of that, We were nice. And they appreciated that. And it was a great time. So I say that because I think wherever you go for the feast, just like running into Sheldon Gingrich, don't assume that this will not have an effect. However light the touch you have, don't assume that it's not going to be understood. And that's, you know, we shouldn't have to tell people, hey, you know, smile. You shouldn't have to tell people, don't grumble at the waitress if the food doesn't come out on time. Don't leave a stupid tip of a penny or something, because that's going to really reflect badly on not you, because they'll never remember you. Just say, stupid church people, you know, whatever. But don't ever discount the power of your great ambassadorship that you bring to a community, because you are being watched. Like, I know a lot of people went to Steamboat. You're watched. You're watched there. You're watched wherever you go. In some of the smaller communities we go to nowadays, you'll be watched. Your presence will be felt. And you may think, hey, I'm blending in. Oh, no. You go dress like this in Texas in the middle of the day. No, you walk into Walmart to buy something. It's after church services on a Wednesday or whatever. You better believe in some of these smaller towns, they're going to know that you don't really belong in this area. You're different. So you always have to be aware of your example. I mean, we shouldn't have to say that, right? But, you know, maybe sometimes we do. For many years, the Church of God Convention in Tucson was the biggest thing here, except for the Gem Show. The Gem Show is still a big thing. It's huge. And when, I think it was the first day we flew in to go house hunting, the Convention and Visitors Bureau had arranged a luncheon where we could meet Billy Joe Varney, who had worked at the University of Arizona, and then he ran the convention center for a few years. And then Pat Tierney, who was the president of the Tucson Convention and Visitors Bureau. And we sat down to lunch, and we had heard of both of them by reputation, and they were just outstanding. And one of the greatest pleasures of my professional career was being able to work with such professional people like that. And so at one point during the end of the meal, during the end of the lunch with Pat Tierney, who was there as the representative of the Convention and Visitors Bureau, he looked at Terry and I and looked us in the eye, and he said, and we could tell we were going to like him immediately, but he said, I was told when I took this job, because he had moved that summer earlier than we did, or moved earlier in the year than we did, from the Kansas City Convention and Visitors Bureau to take this job down here. But he said, when I got here, they told me, there are two things you better not mess up, and that is the Gem Show and a Church of God. As long as you do those things, you have stand a pretty good job of pretty good chance of retaining your job. And he did a great job for us in all those years, and so did Billy Joe Varney. And that was one of the great pleasures that we had in coordinating the feast. I kept my first feast in 1972 in Minehead, England. Terry has attended the church feasts for well over 50 years. Although that's probably not the politically correct thing to say about a woman, right? But a lot of you were in that category. But she was little. She was tiny. She was tiny when she first started attending. Very young, like an infant, little. Before she even was born, she was attending. 10 years, 30 years, anyway. But before I began to keep the Feast of Tabernacles, can we still hear? Long before 1972, there was a man from the Midwest who was keeping the Feast of Tabernacles back in the early part of the 20th century. This man was from the Midwest. He was loosely affiliated with the Church of God Seventh Day. He had learned about the Sabbath. He had learned about the feast days, and he, along with his small congregation, began to be keeping those days for some time. And that man was, as many of you will remember, not Herbert Armstrong, but it was a man by the name of G.G. Rupert. And I gave a variation of a History of the Feast sermon a number of years ago before we went off to the feast. And I talked about some things that I thought were true at the time, but I found out that they weren't necessarily true, that I couldn't, at the time, I didn't find any references to anybody keeping the Feast of Tabernacles through the years. And afterwards, Mr. Tanner came up and said, you know, hey, you may want to take a look at this guy, G.G. Rupert. And when I did, my eyes were opened. And this is a photograph of him. And I guess a lot of men looked like that back in the early part of the 20th century. But probably about 15 years before Herbert Armstrong ever began keeping the Sabbath, G.G. Rupert was keeping the Feast of Tabernacles with his little small flock in Oklahoma. And he eventually went to, talk about parallels in history, this is amazing. He went to Pasadena, California. And from Pasadena, California, which was a vacation spot for the rich and the wealthy during the wintertime throughout the years, but he went to the Southland of California, and based in Pasadena, he had 70 campaigns over the course of a couple of months. 70 Bible campaigns in which he talked about the commandments of God, the Sabbath day, and the feast days. Now that is amazing because years later, in the late 40s, Herbert Armstrong would establish Ambassador College in Pasadena, California. G.G. Rupert was there first. It's kind of crazy. Although we didn't know about this individual, I don't know if Mr. Armstrong ever knew about him or anything, but there is another link which is kind of spectacular. But it's like, you know, the 1969 Apollo moon landing, for those guys to get there and then find out somebody else had planted their flag already on the moon, that somebody else had gotten there before. Mr. Armstrong never knew, to my knowledge, never knew about this individual, but he had a link. He had a link to G.G. Rupert and Herbert Armstrong through the Church of God Seventh Day, because the men that were prominent in the Church of God Seventh Day, which Church of God Seventh Day, Mr. Armstrong always referred to as the Sardis era, and which we'll get into in a little bit, and you probably have heard that before. But the editor of the Bible Advocate, which was the publication of the Church of God Seventh Day, allowed G.G. Rupert to write about the feasts of God in their booklet, in their magazine, which had gone all the way back to the 1860s in various stages, and then eventually was named the Bible Advocate. But it was a publication of the Church of God Seventh Day. Now, they didn't keep the feasts. They allowed this man, G.G. Rupert, to publish articles about his ideas. And his group was the only one that I've been able to find in the United States back in those days, back before Herbert Armstrong, many, many years, who were actually keeping the Feast of Tabernacles. And an individual by the name of Nichols, who used to be associated with the Worldwide Church of God, did a great job in researching all of this, put it up on the internet. You can find his information on the internet, and you know, he did a great work. And so we all owed him a debt of gratitude for putting that there. But the link between Herbert Armstrong and G.G. Rupert were the editors and the prominent individuals of the Church of God Seventh Day. They were prominent with the Church of God through that time. They knew G.G. Rupert beforehand, and these were Duggard and Dodd, ministers of the Church of God Seventh Day, who wrote A History of the True Church, which filled in a lot of the gap of God's people through the ages, traced it all the way from the first century. And there are a lot of others who have done some great work too. So, but there was that connection. So you talk about coincidence. It's amazing what has happened, and you don't think that it is really coincidence when you know all the facts. So this is also very, very interesting. In the early 1960s, before Worldwide Church of God changed its name to Radio Church of God, we established a Spanish work. And the first headquarters of the Spanish work was in Brickett Wood at the newly established college in 1960. But later on, the minister who was first assigned, his name was Ray, R-E-A, he died, and then the Spanish work became the province of another minister that many of you will remember the name, Dr. Charles Dorothy. And he went down to South America at the request of some folks who, guess what? Were keeping the Sabbath, were keeping the holy days without any affiliation with us. It's just like kind of the Angola people have been keeping alive the Sabbath and the feast, and they have modeled themselves after Worldwide Church of God of many years ago. Well, there have been several of these independent groups, but this one was really prominent, and I can't remember whether it was Argentina first or Chile or wherever, but the interesting thing is that these folks were keeping the holy days separate, and they were keeping the Sabbath. Do you know where they got the information from originally? From somebody that had attended those campaigns in Pasadena, California, conducted by G.G. Rupert. The word spread from his work down to South America. And then later on, we kind of reunited with them. And that forms the basis of the Church of God down in South America today. Those people were doing the things that we do. And so it's incredible and mysterious how God works. So we owe a lot to some of these pioneers for preserving the truth and for showing us that, you know, what we're doing today is not all that unique in some ways. There have been others that God has used through the years, which is a terrific lesson, I think, of and by itself. But between 1900 and 1922, when he died, G.G. Rupert taught, and he led his little congregation, Oklahoma, did some evangelistic campaigns in Southern California when it was okay to do those things in Southern California. I don't know how effective they might be in today's Southern California. But later on, his efforts would still be bearing fruit 50 years after he died, which is kind of amazing. So 15 years prior to Herbert Armstrong being called to keep the Sabbath, and we all know the story about how his wife was determined after meeting a neighbor friend in Salem, Oregon, or roundabout in that area, and she said, "I'm going to keep Sabbath," and he says, "No, you're not, and I'm going to prove you wrong," and you know all that story, and he ended up proving himself to be wrong after studying the Bible, and then that led to his understanding of other laws as well, the understanding of the feasts that they should be kept. So Mr. Armstrong and his wife, as you will remember from the autobiography, began keeping first by themselves and then with a small group of other people from the Church of God Seventh Day who also believed, as he and his wife, they kept the holy days. They didn't understand why. They just saw the need to do it. They saw the Bible said do this, right? And so they did. And so in 1937, trying to go through the proper channels and proper procedure, there was a ministerial conference of the Church of God Seventh Day in Detroit, Michigan. Mr. Armstrong had been studying something that, guess what, G.G. Rupert had understood about as well, British Israelism, as it is commonly known. G.G. Rupert knew about, I think he got the tribes mixed up, though, Ephraim and Manasseh. I think he assigned them to different, you know, the U.S. was Ephraim in his view, I think, maybe. But I'll have to review that. But at least he understood where the people of Jacob had settled around the globe, where the people of Israel had been. Mr. Armstrong came to that understanding, as you know, and he presented his findings to the Church of God Seventh Day in 1937. And here is what we find. This is a representation of the original notes. In other words, that's not a photocopy, or that's not a copy of the actual minutes, but it's accurately done with kind of the typewriter font, and it accurately has been copied and represented in this slide as to what took place that day in May 1937. They read the letter of Herbert Armstrong to the 12. I guess these guys were the 12 leading ministers in the Church of God Seventh Day. The article on the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the Passover, Pentecost, Feast of Tabernacles, etc., followed by discussion, pro and con, just like the minutes of the meeting, right? May 10th, may have been, I don't know if May 7th was a Friday, but May 10th may have been the Monday. They went on, proceeding with the investigation of Brother Armstrong's article of the previous sessions, which was left unfinished. Reading the article was completed, followed by discussion. Now, I don't know about you, but for me, when my brother trotted out the United States and British Commonwealth and prophecy, and I've always kind of been interested in history, I started wading through that, and it used to be a hardback book at one time, as some of you will remember, with a lot of detail, maybe a lot more than the ones that we have now, but I started wading through that, and I thought to myself, wow, this explains so much. And it fills in so much of the gap of the Bible that unless you read something like this, you really wouldn't understand. Unless you understood that, wow, at about 1800, all of a sudden Great Britain began to be really great, and then the United States began to grow and to blossom, and in the end of the 19th century and into the 20th century, both these nations would be at their peak of their power. And then Britain would gradually decline, but they would be responsible for defeating the Ottoman Empire. And then that would open up the way. I mean, the Ottoman Empire controlled the entire Middle East. There wouldn't be any Jewish homeland today. There would be no nation of Israel without Big Brother Ephraim conquering the Ottoman Empire, which had controlled that area for 400 years. And when I began to see some of that come, how it had come into play, even though all of it had happened before I was ever born, it began to make so much sense. I mean, people just walk along in life, do they not? Just thinking, oh, I was born in this great country, how lucky am I? You know, this recent tragedy that took place in Mexico, you know, with ex-LDS members migrating down there because of the United States laws passed against polygamy. Hey, this is a tragedy of untold proportions, and I know it's going to be forgotten in a couple of days. But here you have Americans that moved down. These are the people that we all share kind of a common ancestry with, in the sense that the people of this nation came into a rough land. And look what they made of it, because they wanted to stay here. Mexico is a very wealthy country. Their first constitution kind of mirrored the constitution that we have in the United States in 1810. But they got away from that. And ever since the time of Santa Anna, who became a, kind of a literal dictator. And Mexico's history has been shaped differently. But here these people from Utah, fleeing the polygamy laws and everything, no matter, okay, we don't agree with polygamy, okay, but they went down there and they went into these areas of Mexico and they used the same industriousness and they built up those areas, and it's amazing. They have communities of 3,000 to 5,000 spread across the northern part of Mexico and several states, Sonora and Chihuahua, but it's incredible what they were to do down there in a foreign land with good old Yankee ingenuity. But it's amazing when you think about it. If you're a thinking person, if you think it was just a matter of luck, of course, maybe you do. If you've never been exposed to the Bible and the blessings of God and the blessings that he pronounced upon Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob and passed on down through Jacob's sons, Joseph's sons, Ephraim, Manasseh, and then all the rest of the 12 as well. It's amazing when you see that footprint in history. And for me, I just can't deny it. I cannot deny it. And Mr. Armstrong could not deny it either. And so he presented it to these folks his learning on the Feast of Tabernacles and all the other holy days of God and the Passover and everything else. And his compatriots came to the conclusion as they proceeded with reading all of this. And this is their conclusion. Herbert Armstrong, bad guy, troubling the churches. Can you read that back there? They've troubled the churches, teaching them they should observe the Feast of Unleavened Bread. You know, just like Mr. Tannert and Mr. LaRavia and I do every week prior to the Spring Holy Days, we trouble you because we trouble you with keeping them. But we don't really trouble you. So they said, be it moved that we affirm the teachings of the Church of God on this point and also the decision of the apostles and leaders on this question as recorded in Acts 15. Which, you know, if you've read Acts 15, you know it has nothing to do with this. Has nothing to do. It has, you know, to do with abstaining from idol worship. So they came to the wrong conclusion, which shows, you know, they're kind of dimwits, biblically speaking, when you get down to it. I mean, hate to call names, but boy, open up the Bible. And this was not the topic. The feast days were not the topic in Acts 15. It was circumcision. So that had nothing to do with the information that he was proclaiming. But undeterred, Herbert Armstrong went back to his small little group and began doing and continuing his own thing, knowing that he was right, convicted by the Bible, and a couple of years later wrote in a co-worker letter to the members, we look forward to the Feast of Tabernacles. Now, before this, 37, 38, you know, as a spin-off of kind of what they did back in those days, they would have in the summertime, they would have tent meetings, big old huge tents, and all kinds of ministers from every kind of denomination would have evangelistic meetings in big old tents that they would put up. And that's probably the beginning of, you know, kind of the sawdust trail, so to speak, where people would come up and they would begin to give themselves over to God, right? And the altar call to repentance and that sort of thing. Well, Herbert Armstrong's ministry began by doing some of those evangelistic campaigns. And then he decided to use the same methodology in conducting the Feast of Tabernacles. And he said, you know, instead of just having this camp meeting at any other time of the year, I'm going to do it at the Feast of Tabernacles time. Now, everything that I've read from the co-worker letters really didn't indicate until this next one that they began to understand the meaning, why we keep the feast and what it portrays and the reason that we're so zealous about keeping it alive. And that is that in 1939, he was writing at the outset of World War II, and he was writing and associating what was happening at that time. Now his timing was off, as we will all agree and understand. His timing was off at this time, and World War II wasn't the rise of the beast power, right? And we know that now. But he didn't know it at the time, but everything was coming to a conclusion at that particular time in his view. And he said, we've got to come to the Feast of Tabernacles now because, you know, we don't have the mark of the beast. You know, we're not going to keep Sunday. We're going to keep the holy days of God. And he knew what was happening. He knew what the book of Revelation, he knew about all of these things. He was just, you know, a few, maybe a century ahead of the timetable that God has in mind, but still, people need to be motivated, right? People need to be moved to action. And the people were done. And so, this is 1948, a co-worker letter, when he had decided to move the headquarters down to California to take advantage of the technology that was there. Just like this year, Feast of Tabernacles 1948 was a little bit late. It was in mid-October for us, and it was in late October, and he knew about the times. He knew about, as you can read the second paragraph, he knew about the first resurrection. And you see gradually, I don't have all the, I could include every year, you know, coworker letters from 39, 40, 41, 42, 40, but just enough to give you an idea of the progression of thought. And by that time, he had fully gotten it. And he understood what it says in Zechariah. And he was kind of really encouraging in some of these letters the people to make sure that they came to the Feast of Tabernacles. You want to do that. And along with many other people, you and I did that since we came into the church, right? And you could say, well, a lot of those people aren't around. And that's unfortunate. But you are. You're still here. You're still here. And that's the great thing. So Mr. Armstrong quoted the future of the millennium if people decided they're not going to keep the feast. And I guess I stole my brother's thunder when I said this. I didn't realize he was going to use this as an example, but people that don't keep the feast, if whole nations don't keep the feast, like maybe Egypt doesn't keep the feast, there's not going to be rain. And there's going to come a time, Hugh kind of cracked this joke, and he was going to use it later, but I stole it unknowingly from him, but there's going to be a time when they can't use the excuse that it's global warming still, that they got no rain. You see, no rain, okay. When you have to explain it, it never works, right? So down through history with the people of God. As you know, last year I did an extensive search and study into the seven churches of Revelation, and I couldn't find indication that all six of the seven of the churches, or six of the churches to present, kept the Feast of Tabernacles, but I sure found out that some of the people in Thyatira kept it. It was an era that lasted a long time, 600 years, beginning in 1066 or the 1000s, when there were heresies, groups of pockets in southern France where the Spanish Inquisition was going on. And they found these heretics. You know what these heretics were doing? They were keeping the Sabbath day. You know, the effort to eradicate the Jews began a long time ago. Began a long time ago in 325 AD when they were expelled from the Roman Empire along with all other Sabbath keepers. That means the Church of God at that particular time. And I found instances in which we find the people of the Ephesian era were obviously, it's the first era of the Church of God, even to the extension later on, well into the first century, they were keeping the holy days of God, and they were keeping up to the 300s, the people of God we know were keeping the Passover, and that's one of the reasons they were all expelled at that time from the Roman Empire, because Constantine converted to Christianity, which amalgamated all of the false religions of the empire into one little sweet package and called it Christianity. And anybody that didn't keep the first day of the week was sent packing or persecuted to the point of death. Even Polycarp, who was a disciple of John, the Apostle John, Polycarp went to Rome at 85 years old to argue with the chief bishop at Rome. And they basically agreed, I guess, in a gentlemanly way, to agree to disagree. But they were arguing over, not arguing, he was maintaining that the church should not keep Easter with all of its accoutrement and stupid ideas from Babylon, like colored eggs and, you know, worshiping of the ritualistic fertility symbols of rabbits, but that we should be honoring and memorializing the sacrifice of our Savior, Jesus Christ. He didn't win the argument for the Roman church at that time, and what we see now today is the end result of that. He went back to Smyrna and he was burned at the stake for his beliefs. They called him a heretic. There are a lot of people through this era of Thyatira that kept alive the hope that we have. And yeah, I do get a bit emotional about that when I think about what we have here, the relative peace and safety and calm that we have. And I know that there were people by the thousands that gave their lives to keep these days intact. And this particular era, I've been able to highlight particularly, these people knew who they were. They knew they were God's church. They knew that the message of Revelation 2 and 3 was to them. They knew they were in the middle of it, because this isn't the only plaque of what we call the Waldensian era of the Church of God, but it's one of them. And they have the seven stars of Revelation all around there, and their candle is pointing to the fourth star right in the middle, right where they were, the church at Thyatira. Look it up and read it. These folks knew who they were. They knew that they were carrying on that light. And when you read through and you understand that particular insignia, gone off my notes here. Let me see if I can find it again. Guess I'm not, but Lux Lucet in Tenebris means light shining in the darkness. Do you know what period of time that church existed? We call it today the Dark Ages. They knew when they were living. They knew that they were preserving this faith. So it's an amazing story. But let's turn to Deuteronomy chapter 5 and verse 29, because I told you we were going to cover a few passages that we hadn't at the feast this year. Deuteronomy chapter 5 and verse 29, it says, "Oh, that they had such a heart in them that they would fear me and always keep my commandments, that it might be well with them and with their children forever. Go and say to them, return to your tents. But as for you, stand here by me, and I will speak to you all the commandments, the statutes, and the judgments which you shall teach them, that they may observe them in the land which I am giving them to possess." This is kind of the farewell address of Moses to the nation before he goes up into Mount Horeb and stays there, and the rest of the people go. So keep the statutes and the judgments. The holy days were among the statutes of God, the law of God. And that's what he told them to do. And apparently it continued for a while, but a lot of it was lost. It would go hundreds of years into the future in the book of Judges in chapter 21, which is an unbelievable story. And it's hard to believe this story, really. It's just an unbelievably difficult story to believe, because it goes back to what is called Gibeah's sin. Goes back to the rape and pillage of a man's concubine, a Levite's concubine. And because of what happened in that, it all happened in the tribe of Benjamin. And all the other tribes got mad at the tribe of Benjamin for not giving up this town and protecting it. And so they went to war with Benjamin. And they basically annihilated the tribe of Benjamin. They killed man, woman, child, except for about 400 men. And you pick up the story at the end of the book of Judges, and you find that they hated what had gone. Then they didn't really seek God's advice as to what should be done. They came with kind of a preordained attitude of what they should do and said, "Hey, should we do this, God?" And God just allowed it. You can read it for yourself in the previous chapters. It's really a sad point. There was civil war taking place among the tribes of Israel at that time. And so they all got together and they aligned against Benjamin, and they nearly wiped them out. They killed children, men, women, children, yet 400 escaped. 400 of them escaped. And so these 400 were hiding for an extended period of time. And in the tribe, some sense of commonality came into their heads, and they decided, "Wait a minute, we can't allow one of the tribes of Israel to just vanish by killing them all," because they could have done it. You realize that? They could have gotten rid of the entire tribe. But they came to their senses and someone said, you know, we better allow them to live, but the tribe's going to die out. And we've sworn to ourselves that we're not going to give any of our daughters for their wives. So they rounded up as many women as they could in one of the last villages in which they all hadn't been killed of the tribe of Benjamin. And there was enough of them to where, okay, they had a few, but they didn't have enough to provide wives for every man that was still alive. And so they said to themselves, well, we can't break our oath. I'm shortening this up for you. We can't break our oath because we've already sworn that we can't give our daughters. But if you take them, that's a different story. We haven't given our consent. So they came up with this crazy idea at the end of chapter 21. And read it in verse 18. It says, however, we cannot give them wives from our daughters, for the children of Israel have sworn an oath saying, cursed be the one who gives a wife to Benjamin. Now, we've gone on that word and we cannot go back. That's just, you know, that's written in stone now. And then they came up with this great idea. They said, there's this yearly feast that takes place at Shiloh. It was the remnant of whatever had been left of the holy days among the tribes at this dark period of Israel's history. There's a yearly feast in Shiloh, which is north of Bethel on the east side of the highway that goes up from Bethel to Shechem and south of Lebanon. Therefore, they instructed the children of Benjamin. These are the men that hadn't been massacred. Said, so go lie in wait in the vineyards and watch just when the daughters of Shiloh come out to perform their dances. These are daughters of all the rest of the tribes, which they had sworn they'd never would give. And then they had second thoughts, and we better not wipe out the tribe of Benjamin. And every man catch a wife for himself from the daughters of Shiloh, then go to the land of Benjamin. I guess they didn't have Match.com then. This is what they did. Then it shall be when their fathers or brothers come to us to complain, we'll say to them, well, you know, be kind to them for our sakes, because we did not take a wife for any of them in the war. For it is not as though you have given the women to them at this time, making yourselves guilty of your oath. You know, they've just taken them. You didn't give them to them. Took place apparently at some kind of the Feast of Tabernacles. Now, looking beyond all of the horror that had accompanied the slaughter of this tribe, which is in the thousands, 20, 30, 40,000, 50,000 maybe people killed in a civil war, and looking beyond that, I think I've come across the first singles feast, first singles feast dance. No? Okay. All right. A tragic era for all the tribes. Now, moving on through history, 2 Chronicles chapter 5. 2 Chronicles chapter 5. These are another few hundred years into the future now, when Israel has a king and David has died and Solomon is presiding over the dedication of the temple, which took place, we can prove, at the Feast of Tabernacles. 2 Chronicles chapter 5 and verse 3, it says, therefore all the men of Israel assembled with the king at the feast, which was in the seventh month. All the elders of Israel came, and the Levites took up the ark. Then they brought up the ark, the tabernacle of meeting, and all the holy furnishings which are in the tabernacle. The priests and the Levites brought them up. Also King Solomon and all the congregation of Israel who was assembled with him before the ark were sacrificing sheep and oxen and could not be counted or numbered for the multitude. Turn off this. I think that mic will probably be better. Okay. So we find that the feast was being kept at this particular time, and you can read through the rest of this chapter and see that it was kept. Now, this was at the dedication of the temple. We know that the feast days were being kept then. and probably up until after the time of Solomon's death, because notice what happens in 1 Kings chapter 12 when the kingdom is divided now between the north and the south. 1 Kings chapter 12 and verse 32, decision made by the leader of the northern tribes at that particular time, Jeroboam. The kingdom was now divided from David's lineage, from Solomon's lineage. It says, Jeroboam ordained a feast on the 15th day of the 8th month, like the feast that was in Judah, and offered sacrifices on the altar. So he kind of copied the Feast of Tabernacles that was taking place to prevent all the tribes from making this pilgrimage down to Judah, as they apparently had done for a long time. But he changed things up. Instead of the 7th month, when God said to have the feast in various places, Leviticus 23, he said, well, let's put ours a little bit later, in the 8th month and the 15th day. And who knows what else they changed beginning with that particular time. And so he did at Bethel, sacrificing to the calves that he had made. And at Bethel, he had installed the priests, the high places which he had made. So he made offerings on the altar which he made at Bethel on the 15th day of the 8th month, in the month which he had devised in his own heart. And he ordained a feast for the children of Israel and offered sacrifices on the altar and burned incense. It was close enough at the beginning to the original to be just a counterfeit. And it kept people in check, because they were used to going down to Jerusalem, down to the temple, and keeping the feast there. But it's interesting, in the nature of setting up that different time a month later, perhaps it didn't happen all at once, but they probably had a last day observance as well. And we know what the last day observance means in our faith, right? Resurrection, second resurrection, everyone who's ever lived. Well, maybe it didn't happen all at once, and maybe it was a very gradual transition, but I will bet you that that observance began to take on other meanings as they accumulated more and more, as the Bible records through history, more and more of the practices from the nations that surrounded them, which God had specifically forbidden them to have anything to do with. And they gradually accumulated some of these other practices. And just like Christianity has amalgamated these crazy, nutty ideas, the false ideas, and brought them into Christianity and the worship of Christ, I will bet you that that happened in ancient times as well. And we know it did, to the point to where Israel was, anything goes, basically. Sacrifice your kids on the altar to Baal and to Molech and all the rest. Sure, why not? I mean, that's what the other nations did. That's how we can get more rain in due season. Bring your firstborn, burn them alive at the altar. Yeah, they did those things. They found in archaeological excavations those things. And you know what else? I bet if they had any vestige of understanding what the last day meant in the resurrection, in terms of everyone who's ever lived being given an opportunity for salvation, I'll bet that kind of morphed into something else as well. And today, the Christian church has the celebration of All Hallows Eve, where they talk about a rising of the dead. And they actually worship this in the entire Christian world. And then they amalgamate. It happens gradually, see? It happens little by little with the coloring of eggs and stuff like that. That's how it was cute to do when I was a little kid. Had no idea where it came from. Came from Babylon. Came from the pagans. But it's nice for the kids. It's good. It's good. Except they lose everything that is true and right about what the Bible says to do, and they go completely away from that in traditions of men. Now, in Nehemiah chapter 7, we find another revival about 400 years prior to the birth of Christ. The Jews had come back they've gone into captivity. They've come out of captivity. They came out of Babylonian captivity. Some of them did. Most of them stayed in Babylon under the Persian Empire. But they came back, some of them, about 60,000 or so. I can't remember the exact numbers, but it's in Ezra and Nehemiah. And so they came back, and they began working on the temple wall. Then they began working on the temple. Then they got everything put together. And by the time of Nehemiah, in about the middle part of the 5th century B.C., they were beginning to put things right, and they knew that they had a responsibility to keep the Feast of Tabernacles and to bring that in. And so in verse 73, it says, so the priests, the Levites, and the gatekeepers, and the singers, and some of the people, the Nephilim, and all Israel dwelt in their cities. When the 7th month came, the children of Israel were in their cities. Now all the people gathered together as one man in the open square that was in front of the water gate, and they told Ezra the scribe to bring the book of Moses, which the Lord had commanded. So Ezra the priest brought the law before the assembly, and he read from it. He read. It was the first service of the Feast of Tabernacles in that particular year. In verse 6, Ezra blessed the Lord, the great God. Then all the people answered, Amen, Amen, while lifting up their hands. And they bowed their heads and worshiped the Lord with their faces on the ground. Did they understand what we understand today? I don't know, but it's interesting that in verse 8, it says, so they read distinctly from the book of the law in the law of God, and they gave the sense, and they helped them to understand the reading. So this is where we get preaching from, see? We read, and then we try to give some sense, some background information. And that's not a foreign concept. That's a teaching concept that extended 5 centuries before Christ. And they did that in the temple that they had built. And they did that during the Feast of Tabernacles. In verses verse 12, it says, and all the people went their way to eat and drink, to send portions and rejoice greatly, because they understood the words that were declared to them. They understood the meaning and the purpose for which they had been assembled at that particular time. So the law was restored. And it may have been at that time until the 1st century that Jews kept the Feast of Tabernacles in some fashion. So we can trace the history of the feast being kept there. Now, going through earlier history, we see more recent history, we see the evidence of the people of God keeping the annual holy days through the last 2,000 years. We know that Smyrna did. Smyrna is synonymous with the plant myrrh, and it's a thorny plant, or it's almost a tree. It's a short tree, about 8 or 9 feet high. And it's bitter to the taste, but it has a very fragrant odor, very fragrant odor. They make perfume out of it. Smyrna means, I almost went over this. The more this plant is crushed, the better the perfumey smell. So it's crushed and crushed. And that's probably why Christ gave the name Smyrna to this particular group of God's people in Revelation 2 and 3. Because this particular church was crushed and bruised, and it brought out the suffering of that time, brought out the best in those particular people. I mentioned the aspect of Polycarp and arguing about the communion on Sunday and all of that sort of thing. And from the middle of the 2nd century, with the martyrdom of Polycarp until 325, people kept, who were Sabbath keepers, were keeping the Passover. We know that. I haven't found any connections yet regarding Pergamos, but under the two dynamic leaders, both Peter of Breeze and Peter Waldo, who were hundreds of years apart, we find the era of Thyatira was very, very dynamic. The latter stage of that church, the Thyatira area, is called the Waldensians, and the historical evidence that we have, as I mentioned and showed you on the slide, is that they kept the same holy days that we do today. Luke, lux lucid in tenebris, means a light shines in the darkness, which I think is very significant. So that brings us up to pretty close to the present time, when we see that Herbert Armstrong, in the middle of the 20th century or thereabouts, brought the information to the Sardis Church for the second time. I say second time because G.G. Rupert had really brought it to them the first time and given that information and afforded it to the readers of the Bible Advocate. And they published his articles, which is amazing. They didn't agree with him, but it was funny. Just couldn't help themselves. They published his articles. When we read the prophecy in Revelation chapter 3 and verse 2, it says, of the Sardis era, I have not found your works perfect before God. Now, this is an opinion. I've given a lot of facts and stated a lot of historical facts, but this is just my opinion. When Christ says that, it's my opinion that their neglect, when they've been presented the obvious evidence, at least obvious to me, and rejected it, is that that is possibly what it means when it says that their works are not found perfect. And from the time of what is called in American history, religious history, the Anabaptist movement, which traces all the way back to Stephen Mumford and the Church of God from the church in England in the 16th century and brought over to the United States in Rhode Island, we can find elements of God's people. But the understanding of prophecy and the knowledge of the holy days somewhere along the line was lost. And this is, again, an opinion. It's just a hunch that the group that became known as the Seventh-day Adventists, Ellen G. White and all the rest, right? They thought she was a prophet. And they proclaimed that the year 1844 would be the time in which Jesus Christ would return. And it was a failed prophecy, obviously. I think from that point on, the various movements in America that were associated with what we would call the remnants of the Sardis era at that time, I think they basically gave up on prophecy. They don't teach it today in their magazine, which is still going. They don't teach the other thing that we really hold dear, which is the understanding of where we came from as a group of people in the United States and why the United States became great and who we are and what we are. It's, I think, a very, very important thing because, for me, it helps ground me from a philosophical and spiritual point of view to know that there were people that did the same things throughout history that we're doing today. So, for us today, I hope that the understanding and the meaning of the holy days never become something that is old to any of us. We have prevailed from the beginnings of 1973 and the church's introduction to a young, yet-to-be Dr. Sheldon Gingrich, and we have continued on since that particular time. Church history teaches us that a lot of people have sacrificed a lot of things. They've sacrificed their lives for what we are able to do today, and they kept alive the truth that we hold so dear. So, brethren, I'm putting the onus on you. It is your solemn duty, and it's mine as well, but it's our solemn duty to not just observe these days, to live them and to understand them and to honor the memory of all those that the Father has brought to Christ through the ages.